Information about Rabbi Wein's lectures, 1-800-499-WEIN, 1-800-499-WEIN, or rabbiwein.com, rabbiwein.com. This is his lecture on Europe's self-destruction. Rabbi Beryl Wein at JM in the AM.
As long as Rabbi Shurin mentioned the revered Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, I just want to tell you one story. He was probably the cleverest Jew that I ever met. There are learned Jews, many, thank God, not many clever ones. I was sitting at his table, and we were discussing something, and a man came in, and he said he's been dating this woman for a long period of time, and he doesn't know whether he should pull the trigger or not. And he said, you know, the Talmud says that they announce in heaven 40 days before the infant is born that this person is going to marry that person. So he said, if that's the case, how does he know that that's what they announced in heaven? So Rabbi Yaakov looked at him and he said, that's what they call love. And to me, that was the most practical answer that I ever heard to the question, right? That's what they call love. The background to the whole, there are going to be at least one more lecture, maybe two more on the subject. So today's lecture is really a background lecture. How could it happen that in the midst of civilized Europe, in the most civilized country in Europe, in the 20th century, after Europe had adopted democracy and tolerance and all of the Western values that the Western world so treasures, how could it happen that the genocide of a people, 6 million people, should be destroyed? And aside from the 6 million Jews, there also are 3 million Poles that were destroyed. There was close to 12 million Russians that died in the war. I mean, it's just an unbelievable number of people destroyed simply because of their ethnicity, their religion, their beliefs, or the way they looked. So there's a background to that. The all questions that begin with why are difficult to answer. You know, there was a famous exam in the Sorbonne in philosophy, and the final exam the professor put on the board, one question, why? And there were two correct answers. One was because, and the other is why not? It's very difficult to come to an answer. But by knowing the background, at least, we have some inkling of how this great tragedy occurred. Europe at the beginning of the 20th century is finishing almost a century of relative peace. From the Napoleonic Wars, which ended in 1815, till the First World War in 1914, there were not any major wars. There always were minor wars. There was a war in Germany. Bismarck united Germany, and he threw out the Austrians. There was the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, but that only lasted 6 weeks. There was the Crimean War of Russia, Turkey, England. But that also, relatively speaking, was a minor war. And what I mean by a minor war is that it was fought by professional armies and it did not involve great amounts of civilian casualties. There was no air power then, so there were no bombings. Artillery was developed, but a war on the scale of the American Civil War did not yet occur in Europe. The American Civil War, 600,000 Americans were killed in the war. It was the greatest war America ever fought. And all of the modern techniques of warfare were perfected in the American Civil War, but Europe did not learn anything from it. They didn't learn that you can't charge a machine gun nest, or that artillery can destroy entire divisions of troops. And therefore, Europe looked relatively stable. Now, the largest empire in the world was the British Empire. It ruled 25% of the world's surface and one-third of the world's population. And the British Empire, the sun never set on the Union Jack. Australia, New Zealand, India, Ceylon, which today is Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, Africa from South Africa at the bottom till Egypt in the north. It was enormous. And England, Britain is a small island, has a relatively small population. So you had, let's say, 50 million people that ruled over a billion people. And how did they do it? Through naval power. Britannia ruled the waves. The only way you could get from point A to point B was by ship. And the British Navy was unchallenged in its greatness and in its dominion over the seas. The British Navy was built upon a ship called a battleship, which today doesn't exist anymore. But the battleship was a large ship with very heavy armaments, and it could blow any other ship out of the water from great distances. And so England rules the world, and England had a policy that it would not allow any one nation on the continent of Europe to be dominant. There always had to be a balance of power. And that balance of powers would allow England to finagle everything. Now, history, you know, the world is made up of irrational people, many of whom you will meet. You may know some already. Because irrational behavior is what history is all about. And irrational behavior is caused by people who, wouldn't say they're crazy, but they have psychological problems. They need a therapist. Sometimes people like that rise to power. And when that happens, we're in for a rough ride. This is not a comment on the American election. We're talking about the beginning of the 20th century. Now, Russia, where most of the Jews, Ashkenazic Jews, lived under Russian domination. Because Russia then controlled most of Poland, the Baltic states, the Ukraine, and there were 6-7 million Jews in Russia. The Russians were terribly anti-Semitic. The Russian government, the people also, but the Russian government, the Russian church. And in the 19th century, terrible persecutions of Jews occurred. And the Russian government said, our program to solve the Jewish problem is one-third extermination, meaning the pogroms will take care of a third of the people, one-third assimilation, which they meant that one-third will convert to Christianity, and one-third emigration, and one-third will leave. Now, that last part came true. 2.5 million Jews from under Soviet, under Russian control, picked up and left. They went to the United States and Canada, Mexico, Cuba, South America, and a handful went to Israel. In perfect hindsight, if 10 million would have left, it would be a different world, right? But that's not how it works. The Tsar in 1881 was assassinated, Alexander. He was succeeded by a weak Tsar, who died shortly thereafter, and there rose to the throne a man by the name of Nicholas II. And he married a woman who was from the Habsburg Empire, who was German, really, and they were all related because they're all grandchildren of Queen Victoria of England. King of Russia, King of Germany, King of England were all first cousins. There's no fight like a family fight. And she was really a mentally disturbed woman. She had she was paranoid. You know, Nixon said you'd also be paranoid if the whole world was against you. She believed in spiritualism, all sorts of divine signs and miracles, etc. And she completely controlled the Tsar. And she was a bitter anti-Semite. She said all the troubles in Russia came from the Jids. Now, in 1905, Russia fought a war with Japan over Manchuria and parts of China. And the Russians were very xenophobic. So they said these yellow monkeys, boom, won't take anything, will destroy them. And the opposite occurred. The yellow monkeys won. They defeated the Russian army, and they destroyed the entire Russian navy in one battle. Because the Japanese had perfected, as later in the Second World War, had perfected naval warfare. The Tsar had to blame somebody. How could it be that Russia lost a war to Japan? That a European power lost to Asians? And therefore, a series of pogroms were unleashed against the Jews. Pogrom works as follows. The police announced that for the next 3 days they're not going to be in town. You can do whatever you want. So you can imagine, you can imagine that, you know, what would happen in any place in the world almost. And a revolution broke out in Russia against the Tsar. It was led by the left, anarchists, socialists, communists, and many of the leaders of the revolution were Jewish. This is a point that has to be understood and remembered, is that Bolshevism and communism, the left, in the early part of the 20th century was always identified with Jews, because Jews were very prominent in those groups, because Jews like, you know, we like to fix the world, and we like to fix it in 10 minutes. That's our nature. And anybody that offers to fix the world, I have a program that will, everybody's going to benefit from it. It'll eliminate war, eliminate poverty, eliminate disease, give everybody education. It's, I have such a program. You're going to get a few million votes no matter what, no matter how big an idiot you are, because that's our nature. And the prophets of Israel gave us those visions of social justice, of fairness and equality and tolerance, everything with, that Judaism stands for. So therefore, the Jews, many, many Jews, not the majority, but many, many Jews, bought into the ideas of the left. And when Jews buy into an idea, they're very committed to it. And even when the idea collapses, they still don't give up on it. So the revolution against the Tsar, which again had many Jews involved, there were even people who later became great Russia yeshiva who were involved in the revolution, and who went and sat in jail in the Tsar's prisons in Siberia. You won't find that in the official recording of our people. Because of that, therefore, the Tsar had to relent, and he made a parliament, a Duma, which and there were elections, was going to be a democracy, the Tsar was going to curtail his dictatorial powers, but that was all baloney. And 6 months later, he dissolved the Duma, and he remained the dictator. So you had Russia. Now, Russia is too big to defeat. You can't swallow it. It has too many people. It has too large an expanse of land. Russia, China, these countries are not easily defeated. But the Tsar was very much frightened of Germany, his cousin. Because there we have another unstable person, Kaiser Wilhelm II. Now, the Kaiser had a withered arm, so he always tried to compensate for his physical disability by rudeness, aggressiveness, braggadocio. He was a very difficult character. You know, if you go to Jaffa Gate, you'll notice it's the only gate of the gates to the old city, that there's no roof to it. There's nothing on top of it. All of them had an arch or something. And the reason for that was that when the Kaiser visited Jerusalem, so he rode a very tall horse, and he was a tall man, and he wore the German spiked helmet with the feathers, with the whole thing. So he did not fit under the arch of the gate. He would have to bend down. And the Kaiser insisted that the Turks take off the arch rather than he bend down. So when you go by the Jaffa Gate, there's a lot to contemplate, what hubris does to people. Now, the Kaiser said, why should England run the world? Why should my cousin have all of that territory? Germany's also entitled. We want to have colonies in Africa also. Even though the German colonies in Africa never were profitable. So he said, we're going to have parity with the British Navy. And he embarked from 1905 to 1914 on an arms race to build battleships. So the British responded by building a battleship that they called Dreadnought, which is Old English for fear not. But that became the name of a type of ship, dreadnoughts, which were super battleships. And England didn't realize that by building this battleship, they made obsolete all the other battleships that they had. And Germany also now built a dreadnought. France, which was always nervous from Germany, made an alliance with Russia. So you had Germany surrounded on both sides. You had Russia on the east, France on the west, England engaged in a naval competition with Germany. And you have the Kaiser, who is unstable, and the Tsar, who is unstable, in the mix. Now we have to put a few more players in here. There's an empire called the Habsburg Empire, Austria-Hungary. It controlled Austria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, parts of what was once Yugoslavia, Croatia, Slovenia, Montenegro, Bosnia. Now the Balkans is a terrible place. It remains that way until today. There are a lot of different ethnicities and religions there, all of whom don't like each other. And they haven't liked each other for 1,000 years. That's why NATO still has 25,000 troops in Bosnia today, because there was a war in the 1990s. And if they pull out those 25,000 troops, they'll go back to killing each other again. The other empire was the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, which controlled the entire Middle East, here in Palestine then, and part of the Balkans, so that the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburg Empire rubbed up against each other. Not only that, there were a lot of groups in the Ottoman Empire that didn't want to be part of the Ottoman Empire. Greece was not an independent country. It was under the Ottomans. So in the early 1900s, the Greeks revolted and became an independent country. There would be two Balkan wars in 1912 and 1913, in which everybody tried to take pieces of the Ottoman Empire. So Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, Austria, Turkey, but these again were minor wars, and eventually the great powers, England, France, Germany, intervened and made a settlement. There was a place called Bosnia, which still exists today, and Bosnia is divided between the Turks, the Muslims, and the Serbs, who are Slavic Christians. Serbia was a small independent country. It's across the river, the Danube River, from Austria. Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, is on the river. And the Serbs were determined to undermine the Austrian Empire. They dreamt of a greater Serbia, which happened after the Second World War, when Tito took over Yugoslavia. So Yugoslavia was really Serbia controlling everybody else. The emperor of the Habsburg Empire was a man named Franz Joseph. He was the emperor for 60 years. He was an anti-Semite, but he was a moderate anti-Semite in the fact that he issued edicts of toleration. In other words, Jews in the Habsburg Empire were far better off than they were in the Russian Empire. And therefore, a lot of Jews moved. Austria also controlled a slice of Poland called Galicia. And there were a lot of Jews in Galicia, especially Hasidic Jews. So what happened was that these Hasidic Jews began to move to Vienna, because it was all part of the same empire. Well, the Viennese did not appreciate these funny-looking, funny-smelling people coming to live in Vienna with fur hats on the Sabbath, and they don't speak German. They speak a jargon. So there was a great deal of anti-Semitism in Austria, and in fact, most of the Nazis, as we will see later, most of the Nazi leaders were Austrians and not Germans. Hitler himself, Eichmann, etc., they were all Austrians. So now you got all the ducks in the pond. The Emperor Franz Joseph had no heir. His son had died in his lifetime. So the heir was a nephew, the Archduke Ferdinand. And here's where Rabbi Yaakov's story comes into play. He fell in love with a lady.
We'll get back to that story coming up here at JM in the AM. Rabbi Beryl Wine has been lecturing this morning on the topic of Europe's self-destruction here at JM in the AM.
And there were a lot of Jews in Galicia, especially Hasidic Jews. So what happened was that these Hasidic Jews began to move to Vienna, because it was all part of the same empire. Well, the Viennese did not appreciate these funny-looking, funny-smelling people coming to live in Vienna with fur hats on the Sabbath, and they don't speak German. They speak a jargon. So there was a great deal of anti-Semitism in Austria, and in fact, most of the Nazis, as we will see later, most of the Nazi leaders were Austrians and not Germans. Hitler himself, Eichmann, etc., they were all Austrians. So now you got all the ducks in the pond. The Emperor Franz Joseph had no heir. His son had died in his lifetime. So the heir was a nephew, the Archduke Ferdinand. And here's where Rabbi Yaakov's story comes into play. He fell in love with a lady. Most of the aristocratic marriages were arranged marriages. The one that you loved became your mistress. The one you were married to was your wife. That's the way it worked. But he fell in love with a woman by the name of Sophie, and she was a commoner. She was not from royal lineage. And he insisted on marrying her. He fell in love with her. He insisted on marrying her. It's the same thing that happened with the Prince of Wales, Edward VIII, in the 1930s, which we'll also get to, I hope. It just shows how strange history is, right? Yeah, history is great events, right? There's the... Who wants to marry Sophie? And because of that, the emperor said, well, my nephew can become the next emperor, but she will never be a queen. She has no rights. Which made for great tension, as you can imagine, in the family and in the whole empire. Now, Ferdinand and Sophie took a trip to Sarajevo in 1914, in June 1914. Sarajevo is in the Balkans, it's in Bosnia, and there were a group of assassins, Serbian, who went there with the express purpose of assassinating Ferdinand and Sophie. And again, by all sorts of ineptitude, they turned out to be successful. So the Archduke was killed, and the Austrian Emperor and the Austrian government said that Serbia did it, because the ones that did it, Gabriel Princip, he was a Serb. And the Serbian government backed it. If you go to Theresienstadt, Terezin, in Czechoslovakia today, outside of Prague, so there is a prison there. It was a concentration camp in the Second World War. Previously it was an Austrian prison. And outside the cell where Gabriel Princip was held until his execution, every day somebody puts a new bouquet of flowers. It's more than 100 years later. So it gives you an idea of Balkan memory. It doesn't just go away. So the Austrian government presents Serbia with an ultimatum. And under the terms of the ultimatum, Serbia has to punish the perpetrators, but it's an ultimatum that would not allow Serbia its natural sovereignty over its own affairs. The Serbs are Slavs. They're from the Slavic race. Russia always feels that it is the protector of the Slavs, because Russia is the largest Slavic entity in Europe. And therefore, Russia says, don't bother the Serbs, because if you bother the Serbs, we will have to intervene. Russia, remember, had an alliance with France. And under the terms of the alliance, if Russia goes to war, France has to go to war. Germany is alarmed. But the Germans had a plan. The Kaiser had a plan. The Kaiser's plan was that he would conquer France in 6 weeks the way they had done it in 1870. It was named after a general, the head of the German general staff, von Schlieffen was his name. And after they conquered France, after they defeated France, they would turn east and defeat Russia, which is the same thing that happened in the Second World War. And the Kaiser therefore told the Austrians, he gave them what was called a blank check. He said, if you go to war against Serbia, we'll back you. we will protect you from Russia. Now, part of the plan of the invasion of France was to go through Belgium. Now, Belgium was an artificial country created in 1815 after the Napoleonic Wars. It was meant to be a buffer between Germany and France, between Holland and France. It's divided today between Dutch-speaking and French-speaking people. There always are problems regarding that. And because of this, England had guaranteed the borders of Belgium. So if Germany invades France through Belgium, England is going to have to go into war. And that is the story of how World War I begins. World War I will be the beginning of the Holocaust for the Jewish people. If we would not have Yom HaShoah for the Second World War, we would have to have a Yom HaShoah for the First World War. Because hundreds of thousands of Jews are going to be killed. The whole Eastern Front between Germany and Russia and Austria will be fought in the areas where the heaviest Jewish population was. It will upset all of the infrastructure of Jewish life that had been built up over hundreds of years in Eastern Europe. And there were Jews in every army. In other words, Jews were fighting each other. There were 12,500 Jews who died in the German army fighting for Germany. There were Jews in the French army, including Colonel Dreyfus, Captain Dreyfus. There were Jews in the Russian army. Now, peculiarly enough, the German army was the kindest army to the Jews. The Russian army was the most vicious against the Jews. The Russian army perpetrated countless pogroms. But the German army, there were Orthodox Jewish chaplains in the German army. And when they came to a community and the Germans conquered it, so the Orthodox Jewish chaplains were enabled to rebuild the mikveh, to put up the eruv, to provide all the religious infrastructure necessary. Those same German officers would come 20 years later and shoot every Jew in the street. But it will help explain why the Jews didn't figure out what was going to happen to them. Because of the fact that in their living memory, they remember the German army. This war was supposed to be over in 6 weeks. Well, you know, it's easy to start a war. It's very hard to end it, to get out of it. The war lasted over 4 years. It consumed over 20 million people. An entire generation in England and France and Germany was lost. The Russian army finally revolted against the Tsar. They didn't want to fight any longer. And there came a second revolution in 1917. It was called the February Revolution. And that revolution installed a democratic government under the leadership of a man by the name of Kerensky. And Jews were very prominent in it. But in October 1917 was the third revolution, the October Revolution. And this was headed by Lenin and his Jewish assistant, Leon Trotsky, whose real name was Bronstein. Trotsky has a descendant who lives here in the old city. He's a Jew with the beard and payas, and he wears his tzitzis outside. It's an interesting story. He was interviewed, and they said, they asked him, what would your grandfather say if he saw you now? And he said he would understand. He said he was a believer. We were all believers, he said. We just believe in the wrong thing, but we're all believers. By the way, he said his family never intermarried. They only married Jews. But you had Trotsky, you had Kamenev, you have Zinoviev. You had the leaders of the Bolshevik Revolution were Jewish. And that was the association of, that I explained before, Bolshevism with the Jewish people, which had dire consequences, both inside and outside Russia, and which continues until today. The romance of the Jews with the left. Now the left has left us. They don't like us anymore. But the Jews still like the left. So it's unrequited love, which is hard to deal with. This war destroyed Europe. Till today, the effects in Europe, in England and France, they call it the Great War. World War II, even though it was longer and more costly in terms of lives and everything. But the Great War is World War I. And out of it came two interesting things for the Jews. The Talmud says that the punishment of a liar is that eventually he believes his own lies. The punishment of the anti-Semite is eventually they believe their lies. So, in Germany, for instance, and in England, there were premier leaders in the government who believed that the Jews somehow control the world. There's a committee of Jews that meets between Minch and Meirith, and they decide what's going to happen. Now, because of the fact that Wall Street was predominantly Jewish, and the Wall Street bankers financed both sides of the war, so they made money no matter what happened. So in their mind, you know, the Jews. So in early 1917, with the war stalemated, Germany got the idea that the Zionist movement had remained completely neutral in the war, because there were Jews on every side. But the Germans got the idea that if they promised the Jews that they would give them Palestine, then the committee would decide to back the Germans. You can't make this up. England found out about it, so they preempted it. And Chaim Weizmann, the head of the Zionist movement, was in England. And he was a chemist. He had helped England develop a fuse for its shells. And he had influence. He knew people. In any event, eventually, the British Foreign Office wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild, who was the head of the Jewish Board of Deputies. And they said, His Majesty's government view would favor the establishment of a national Jewish homeland in Palestine. That's the famous Balfour Declaration. Rav Kook said that the whole war and all of the millions of casualties was only through heaven's way of leading to this, because the Balfour Declaration gave legitimacy to the Zionist movement and to, in international circles, to the Jews having proprietorship in the land of Israel. Now you have to remember, in 1900 there were 6,000 Jews here. In 1920 there were 60,000. In 1948 there were 600,000. In 2014 there were 6,300,000. So if you just think of that, you know, something's going on. After the war, America eventually entered the war against Germany, and that tipped the scales against Germany. But the German army never surrendered. There was an armistice. The German army, Germany itself was never invaded. And the German army retired, intact almost, back to Germany. But the Allies imposed a very harsh peace treaty called the Versailles Treaty, in which they made Germany pay enormous amounts of money as reparations. They took away territory from Germany. They intended somehow to punish Germany for the war. And they created what was called the League of Nations. The League of Nations is the forerunner of the UN. It was supposed to settle all, because the war was so terrible, they called it the war to end all wars. Nobody's ever going to go to war again. And look what happened there. Europe is destroyed. And the League of Nations confirmed the Balfour Declaration. And it gave mandates to major powers. The mandate meant that you would run this little country until the population was able to run it by themselves. And the mandate for Palestine was given to England, and it was given on the condition that they would hold it for the Jews. And naturally, the Arabs didn't agree. But they gave the Arabs, they gave them Saudi Arabia, they gave them Iraq, they gave them Syria, they gave them Lebanon. All of these were carved out of the Ottoman Empire. They never were countries. And that's part of the joy that we see today in the Middle East, is that, you know, you can draw them on the map with a pencil, but that doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean anything. You got Kurds and Shiites and Sunnis and Alawites, all sorts of people who, again, for thousands of years have not liked each other. But we want to solve it in 10 minutes. We know the solution, which is always the weakness of the West. It's the weakness of the left, and it's the weakness of the Jews. You know, there are vast topics that are discussed in the Talmud. And after a long discussion, the Talmud will say, Kasha, we didn't answer the question. And then it keeps on going. So what do you mean you didn't answer the question? But in that lies a great deal of wisdom, right? In Yiddish, they used to say, "Fanakasha starved minute." Nobody ever died because of a question. Meaning, you got to live with problems. Not every problem has an immediate solution. And this is all going to lead the Communist Revolution, the Versailles Treaty, the Balfour Declaration, the fact that Germany was defeated but felt that it was betrayed. This is all going to lead to the unbelievable and unpredictable rise of Hitler and Nazism in the 1920s and 1930s, which will eventually lead to World War II and to the genocide of the Jewish people in Europe. So that's what the next lecture will be about. And I thank you for your attention, and I wish you a very happy Purim.
There is Rabbi Beryl Wein, the European Europe Self-Destruction Part 1 here at JMN.